Joe's End of the Apes franchise.
Adam's End of the Apes franchise. And listen, we're not calling...
Apes franchise?
We're not calling it the Apes franchise.
This episode?
Yeah, we're not.
The Apes trilogy?
I'm concerned that people from the old days will just think, oh, they don't know how many films are in the Planet of the Apes.
Which people from the old days do you imagine would A, listen to this, B, be concerned with how many films we think are in there? Do you know how many? Quick question, how many films are there?
Well, in the original
set. In all the Apes, all Apes films.
No, we're talking about, they're all sets, mate. The original set is five. There's five of them. There's Planet, there's Beneath, there's Escape, there's Return, there's Beyond. There's
Conquest.
Oh, Conquest. There's a TV series.
Here we go. Planet of the Apes. Beneath the Planet of the Apes.
Yep.
Escape from the Planet of the Apes.
Yep, said that.
Conquest of the Planet of the Apes.
You said that.
Battle for the Planet of the Apes.
I didn't say
And then that. In 2001, there was the remake Planet of the Apes.
Stop.
Mm-hmm.
We're not...
That's a new set.
Yeah, new set, mate. Talk about sets.
Yeah.
Can we call this the Planet of the Apes set?
I just think that's needlessly confusing.
So anyway, how many in the original set?
Five. Then there was one remake, and then there was three in the new.
Three in the new.
There's four in the new.
No. The fourth is coming out, and I don't count the
Kingdom
four.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, that's why we're doing this.
We're doing this?
Because I said this will be good for numbers. It's back in the canon.
Right. Has it got circus in it?
That's a great question. I know.
Because what's his face?
Why are you asking me questions and not letting me fucking answer?
Right, go on.
I knew that there were five for starters.
You didn't even
understand that there were sets.
No.
You keep asking me questions and then just...
When you say sets, it sounds like you're talking about like a fox litter or something, you know?
Well,
a litter of foxes. We're talking about chimps here.
What do you call a kind of a gaggle of chimps?
I think it's
You think. If you don't know, just say I don't know. If you don't know, just say I don't know.
What do you call that? What's the plural? It's a troop. It's a troop or a tribe.
It's a troop.
A troop or a tribe. So should we call this the Planet of the Apes troop?
Well, we shouldn't really, because the troop is the original five.
That's true.
And this is only
what about
three.
The troops? The troop and the tribe.
I don't think three's enough for a tribe. No. And I don't think, just because Kingdom is coming out, I don't consider that to be part of, whilst it continues the story, it's not really part of this original three. Also, interestingly, it's a new set of three. It's four. It's 200 years, 300 years in the future. It's been so long since War. War was 2017. Oh, did you know? Doing this, I always thought it was War of the Planet of the Apes, and it's War for the Planet of the Apes.
Do you know, I know that's so funny, but they will have had serious meetings about that.
I mean, I remember people finding it laughable about the rise of the planet of the, and then dawn of the planet of the. It's a lot of of those. There's two of those.
Too many of those. How many of those is too many? More than one. Yeah.
You wanted to talk about, it feels like we're already talking about apes, but I know you wanted to talk about your week in film. Should we reverse?
Yeah.
And you start talking about other films and then we can ease back onto apes.
But I'd love to go backwards as a human and tell you about a couple of films I watched this week, Adam. I actually don't know if you've seen either of these. I'm curious. Have you seen All of Us Strangers?
No. So you can't talk about it because I don't want to hear anything about it from you.
And would you take a recommendation?
Listen, mate, you're the recommender of that film. Society's recommended that film, my friend.
I know society's recommended it, but that doesn't preclude me from also being a recommender. I'm not the recommender. I could be a recommender for you if you just let me.
As long as you identify yourself as a recommender and not the recommender, and when I watch it and I say, oh yeah, I quite like that, as long as you don't say, oh yeah, I recommended you that film.
Sure, sure. Okay. Well, it's very tempting to do that now. You've laid out that marker. But no, I would never do that because I know that this film is has been recommended by society, by everyone. It's interesting. I'd be curious to know what you think about that. That's the, for listeners who are unaware, that's the film with Andrew Scott, Paul Mescal. I won't say anything about it.
It's lined up. I've got Disney Plus. That's not a promotion. Just because I want to act. I got it for the Apes films.
Right.
It's got all the Apes films.
It does.
Not all of them. Just the current set. Anyway, you know, it's got all of the Strangers on there. And my wife saw it. She recommended it to me.
Did she?
And at some point, I will watch it.
Now, here's a serious question for you, okay? If I were to recommend a film, and your wife were to recommend a film, whose recommendation would count more to you? Yeah, which one would mean more?
That's good. Because
your wife, you hold your wife dearly, you love her more than me, more than anyone else apart from your children, and I accept that and understand it. However, does she know movies like I do? Yeah. Does she really understand the chaos that is you in the movie context in the way that I do?
Well, she's just not seeing as much as you. This is the woman I took to see Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas on our first date. She gets it.
Well,
with this, her recommending it, I do. It matters more than you because we saw.
Oh.
The director's previous film together, 45 Years. I think we've probably both seen Weekend. So contextually,
right,
she's just pipping you at the post.
But in this case, she went and watched this one without you. That's interesting. I would never do that.
Well, we can't go to the cinema anymore because we have children.
Yeah.
And so
right,
that's a treat. If someone stays and looks after the kids and the other one gets to go out and enjoy themselves.
I see.
That's what life's like.
Yeah.
And I like going to the cinema by myself, so I'm really up for that.
So if when you watch this film and you do enjoy it, I know mine was a recommendation, so I'm not allowed to say, hey, I recommended that to you, but would you accept her saying that?
No, because again, society has recommended this film. I was aware of this film before she saw it.
You can be aware of a film and then be recommended to go and see it, right? Like,
yeah, but I'm ignoring that.
Okay.
I'm putting my fingers in my ears and going, I've already heard about this film. I know the director. Mm-hmm. I know the actors. They're massive. Your recommendation is basically a waste of time.
Well, here's another recommendation for you. And I'm glad to hear that you've got Disney Plus now because it's in the top, like, featured suggested movies alongside All of Us Strangers. It's the film by Taika Waititi, Next Goal Wins. Have you seen that one, Adam?
I will never watch that film.
Yeah. Tell me why.
Two words. Taika Waititi.
I was thinking this about it because I think it's sort of fine, you know. It's okay as a film. It's
you can tell me whatever you want about it.
Thank you.
I'm just going to listen now because I don't care.
Well, it's a story that I've known for a long time. A friend of mine who's a football author, writer, wrote a book called 31-0, which is about the game that this story is kind of based on, or at least it starts out in relation to. And it's the story of American Samoa, their football team, and how they're the worst international football team in the world. They famously lost 31-0 to Australia in a World Cup qualifier. And I think it's continued to be the record score in any official like FIFA qualification game. And obviously it's a tiny island. There's not that many people that live there. But late 2000s, a Danish-American coach, Thomas Rongen, gets appointed to be their new manager. And basically, he goes there and he helps them score their first ever goal and win their first ever game, right? So it's a great story, and it's all, you know, that. And I can totally understand why somebody would want to make a film out of that. There's a documentary about it too, which is really, really good and worth watching. And I think Taika Waititi himself says, if you want to watch the true story, watch the documentary. And I think, you know, kind of owns the fact that there are a couple of tweaks, shall we say, for the film version. But the film, I didn't really have very high expectations anyway. It does have Michael Fassbender in it, playing Thomas Rongen, who I always enjoy to watch.
Does he work? Can I interject? Yeah. Does he work in this kind of comedic? It feels like he's not really played this kind of role before, this comedic role. Am I wrong?
The bits where it works, he's really funny. So there's about halfway through the film, there's a kind of midpoint montage, and when he's really the only character that speaks, it's a quick kind of supercut of him doing funny bits, saying funny things, and there's a kind of a narrative arc with his character and a theme that he can never really see anything through. You know, he wants to storm into the dressing room at halftime and give that really empowering, empathetic halftime speech, but he just can't. It always falls flat on its face, which is funny because I think that's kind of what happens with the film. If I made the film, which I obviously can't and wouldn't, but if I had made it, I would have accepted that it is the perfect story to make a kind of 90s, early 2000s type lighthearted film about, and cast a kind of straight guy role
cool runnings,
in that main
cool
role.
Runnings.
A cool running style, right? Most of the film requires Michael Fassbender to play the straight guy, and he's not doing that because he's obviously been instructed otherwise. So when
shit director Taika Waititi.
So when the film coalesces around him, he is really funny, and that really works for moments. But most of the film needs him to be straight so that the other people around him can be really funny. And too often, like, everyone's being funny. It doesn't really work. And if I was being cruel, I would say the main failure of the film for me as a viewer is that it cannot stop and accept often enough, or maybe at all, that not everything has to have a comedic punchline. Not every swelling emotional moment needs to have the wind taken out of it by a joke. And I honestly think if it was made 20 years ago, it would be a better film because of that. Like, it has a bit of emotional punch, but it just doesn't deliver. And I think it's damaged by the fact that it's made by a comedian.
That man, Waititi, has just been dining out on What We Do in the Shadows, and that wasn't even entirely
which is very funny.
Yeah, sure, but that's not, you know, that's him and Jermaine Clement.
Sure.
And everyone just seems to think he's the guy. He's the guy with the mojo. No, he's not. You watch Thor, Love and Thunder, and you tell me that man has got a fucking clue about anything.
Yeah. Well, you really wouldn't like this film. You wouldn't.
You know, I think What We Do in the Shadows is perfectly fine.
I think it's really funny.
People
though.
Think it's really funny. Yeah, but you see, I've seen Spinal Tap, and I got my fill of that, you know, from Spinal Tap. I don't need to see the rip-off with vampires.
Fuck's sake.
You know, that's just me. That's
there's only one mockumentary allowed. You can't make any more. There's nothing else fun to be found here.
I want to ask a question, but we're 20 minutes in. Hello, and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmond, and joining me as ever, it's the leaky boy, Joe Devine.
Hello there.
This is the show in which me and my pal, Joe, talk about the movies we forgot we'd seen, even seen in the first place.
Oh, didn't we just?
On today's episode, it's a tough one to tee up. But I'm going to tee it up. It's just one film. It's we're going to talk about the 2011 flick. Huh?
Well, we did watch three films, and I think we will be talking about all three of them. At least I will be.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, never mind that. No one's interested to our little petty squabbles.
Sure. Dawn. War.
I'm not... I've only got time. No one wants to read... And also, no one wants to hear me read out three letterboxed.
Yes, they do.
I'm just going to intro Rise. Okay, there are two subsequent films, Dawn of and War 4. War 4. So this is... today, on this episode, we're going to be talking about Rise of the Planet of the Apes. The 2011 sort of... I guess it's actually a prequel to the original set. Yeah, it's the prequel to the original set of films.
It's the prequels. It's like, you know, Anakin was born and got in a thing.
We've done it. The prequels.
Yeah.
Let's call it the Planet of the Apes prequels.
Yeah, okay. We can call it that. That's fine with me.
So this is Rise of, I'm going to call it Rise of throughout, the 2011 flick directed by Rupert Wyatt, who I always confuse with Rupert Sanders, who Rupert Sanders directed the Ghost in the Shell remake.
Oh, that with the you've been trying to get me on that.
I'm going
to
get you. And then Sanders is doing the Crow remake.
Ah, the Crow. Horrible. Do you know, the Crow was as a young teenager, maybe 12, 13, I used to pretend that I had seen and liked The Crow because it seemed like the kind of scary, dangerous film that a young, scary, dangerous boy should like.
Yeah, and I had watched it for the same, but for the same reason. It's neither scary nor dangerous. But this is directed by Rupert Wyatt. This is a deliciously punchy 105 mins. I cannot stress that hard enough. That is bang on the length that this kind of film should be.
Mm-hmm.
And here is The Letterboxd. Oh no, I haven't said who it stars. Who does it star?
You can't go longer, really, when it's all monkeys.
No, no, it's not about monkeys. It's about the genre, mate. So who have we got? We've got James Franco features. Yep. With Frida Pinto in a appallingly underwritten role. Appallingly. I can't, this is all I'm going to mention her. I just feel so bad for her and how she was treated. John Lithgow, Brian Cox again popping up. You've got Draco Malfoy popping up. And of
Cox
course,
everywhere.
Of course, you have got Andy Serkis playing
Is he in the film?
Mo-capping Caesar. No, he's mo-capping. He's mo-capping.
He's Caesar. Yeah.
He
is
Caesar, the main ape.
Yeah.
Oh, now let's do the Letterboxd.
Yeah.
Evolution becomes revolution. Scientist Will Rodman, Franco, is determined to find a cure for Alzheimer's. It's always Alzheimer's. The disease which has slowly consumed his father. Will feels certain he is close to a breakthrough and tests his latest serum on apes, noticing dramatic increases in intelligence and brain activity in the primate subjects, especially Caesar, his pet chimpanzee. And that is where the Letterboxd ends. What a baffling summary.
That is quite...
That's quite top-heavy. That's a quite top-heavy summary. It doesn't really get into the meat of the movie.
Well, do you know what else is top heavy?
Oh, please don't tell me what.
It's a chimpanzee, of course.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're all muscle.
Before we get into anything, I think we've got a kind of... There's an elephant in the room. You know,
There's an elephant as well.
There's an Andy Serkis-shaped elephant in the room. And when I say that, what I mean is Andy Serkis is in his little motion capture suit and he's being put up on the screen and it's appearing to be a large elephant and he's using his arm as the trunk and he's making the noises. I said some things about Andy Serkis quite a few episodes ago in the Logan episode. And Joe's just going to drop in a little clip of what I said.
How about this though? Would you not consider Andy Serkis? Would you not consider Andy Serkis his turn as Gollum or a Schmeagle?
No, I think it's a great shame that Andy Serkis got any kind of attention from these films because it made him think that he could act in actual films.
Oh, that's
and when you see
no.
him when you see him at him in a film acting, it's like. I think he thinks he's got little like blue dots on him and he thinks it's going to get turned into a performance later because it's fucking, he just thinks, oh, everything's 11. He's like, let's dial it up to 11. It's like, no, Andy, don't worry. It's not, you haven't got little blue dots on you or little ping pong balls on you. This is the performance. And I don't think he realizes.
No,
because
that's
it's just,
too mean.
He's just, well, I guess
I
what?
Like
I
him.
Started it and I wanted to finish it. He is appalling in everything as everything. And, you know, the fact that he invented some new acting style, ping pong acting, you know, we're all supposed to be so excited and with a rubbish voice. And it's just like, fuck off. He's rubbish. Everything he's ever been in is rubbish. And anyone who thinks he's a good actor is deluded. So that's what I said about Andy Serkis.
I thought we'd consigned it. I thought we'd consigned it.
So did I. Listen, I don't want to... I thought what I said afterwards... Uh-huh. I'm not lying. I'm not lying when I say this, and it's quite embarrassing. I thought that was one of the funniest things I'd ever said because it kind of came to me and I said it and it made me really, really laugh.
Sure.
The notion of it. And then I watched Rise of the Planet of the Apes again. And it was all based on, I saw this at the cinema. I haven't seen this film in over a decade. I've just watched, you've made me watch Lord of the Rings. And so in my mind, Serkis is, in my mind is him being in Marvel films.
Yeah.
And like his kind of over-egged Gollum performance, which I never really rated. Okay, so that's me in the past. That's my context. Now this is me growing as a human being.
You've just watched Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
And I'm just... He makes this film. It's not a great film, but and we can get onto that. But he is he's really good as really overselling. He's obviously got to act big and it comes out smaller in when it's the ape. But there's some lovely moments and across.
Is this you swallowing circus humble pie?
This is elephant-sized humble pie. And also, and I know I said I wasn't going to talk about the other two films, but in the second two, he completes the whole arc. He does a whole arc for Caesar, and he gets better. You know, the special effects get better. His performance really lands. And I get why people really love this trilogy. This is where he makes sense, and I'm glad he's about and he did it. I don't want him to be in a live-action movie, though. So that's all. That's my circus bit.
I would say you have grown as a person there, because not only did you swallow that elephant-sized humble pie about your previous remarks.
Thanks for the cream.
You also,
thanks for the cream on top.
Yes, you're very welcome. You referred to it as... Instead of ping pong acting, you refer to it as what?
Mocapping.
Is that what it's called? Mocapping.
Well, it's motion capture, and I think those in the trade call it mocap.
Those in the trade, you're in the trade. That's interesting. Well, I just think that's not.
I can't believe you just had to. You just had to under your breath, like I'd let it go.
No, no, there's nothing under my breath.
I'm
there.
Not just, in the trade.
Listen, I'm glad that you know the trade language because you're in the trade. The point I'm trying to make is that not only have you swallowed that humble pie, you've also respected him and his craft enough to name his craft instead of calling it ping pong acting. I'm proud of you. I think the audience are proud of you. I think your peers and colleagues in the trade are proud of you.
Are these films close to your heart? Like, what are the Apes movies mean to you? And like, because you've obviously not even seen the originals, right?
I've seen the original film. I haven't seen the other four.
You've not seen Beneath. Beneath's quite good.
I've not seen Beneath. I've not seen Conker. I've not seen Sabotage 4. I've not seen the Clerk's Desk of.
The original Apes is kind of... It's what I believe it's supposed to be. And it was based on this French book. Don't know what it's called. It's a satire of... Because it's all about these kind of strict hierarchies.
Yeah,
you know, the orangutans do something and the gorillas do something else and all that kind of stuff. And it's a class thing. And what I like about the new ones is they're not interested in that at all. It's got, and also Rise in particular is really, it's quite a few movies in one is Rise. It's a mad scientist movie. It's a kind of escape from prison movie. And then it's a kind of an uprising movie. In 105 minutes,
sure,
it fucking rattles along like nobody's business. It's almost like the film is scared to stop and do anything like characterization or, you know, story depth.
Well, on that point, I the main thing that caught my attention when I watched Rise this time around was that the film, I think probably in an effort to not stop and just to canter along, it doesn't bother at all to try to emulate a realistic corporate or professional environment. It just does whatever is going to move the story along quickest. And however that manifests in a scene, I felt as though the writer, the director, the actors, they didn't care at all. I was curious to know whether you thought, is that a strength here? Because partly I felt like I was watching it going, well, that wouldn't work. That wouldn't work like that. That's not the function of the board, you know. But I guess it doesn't matter. Does it? Doesn't matter. You want it to just rumble along.
It's all about story and just getting to the apes. Like, they want to pack so much in to get this new franchise started. And I think this film generally was considered to be a bit of a joke. And everyone just thought, no one needs this. I think the memory of Tim Burton and his attempt was still very fresh. And and then the name Rise of the Planet of the Apes, everyone just thought this is going to be really stupid and pointless. And you can feel the film is aware of that. And so it just it's got to get along. It's got to get going. Let's have this corporate environment that clearly doesn't exist, and we'll just have them going. You know, the opening sequence is James Franco giving his big speech about how amazing his research is, and at the same time, the key ape escapes and then somehow bursts into his speech.
Yeah,
and it's like, how is that in any way likely to happen? But you watch it and you go, yeah, that's what the story needs. Franco needs to be shunned, and we know his dad's got Alzheimer's. He needs to test the drug on his dad.
Franco's got to go rogue.
He's got to go rogue. He's got to be a mad scientist. It's all got to go wrong. He's got to take an ape home. Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
We're 15 minutes in and he's got an ape home. Let's get this party started. And you just fucking, it's like, I don't care. Frida Pinto, I'm sorry. Yes, we'll meet you, but you're not going to get a look in. It doesn't matter. I feel really bad for you as an actress, but fuck it. Let's just crack on.
Frida Pinto, who plays James Franco's love interest, she shows up, and then it's pretty much immediately 5 years later, and she's virtually wearing the same clothes she was in the previous scene. And the characters have zero chemistry. It's not clear that they live together. It's not even clear that they're in a relationship, really. They're just, it's like, hang on, why is he still with this vet? Wasn't that 5 years ago?
5 years later, they're lying on a picnic blanket.
It's so strange.
She's his conscience, his vocal conscience. Yeah. Oh,
sure.
It's 5 years later and he suddenly spills the beans. Yes, I took this ape home. Yes, I raised him. Yes, I tried to cure my dad of Alzheimer's. Get off my case, you fucking
Get off my
harridan.
Case. Yeah, seriously. Why did you follow me home? You're a veterinarian. Anyway.
Sorry.
The thing I wanted to pick you up on was that you said before that these new films, this set, the prequels, as we've agreed to describe them, The Tribe, is not concerned with the same sort of, you know, big global machinations that the original films were concerned with. I disagree with that.
I know you're going to pull my pants down. Pull my pants down.
I'm not going to pull your pants down. I agree that the hierarchy, the societal hierarchy, class elements of it don't appear in as much. But the reason I say that I think the films are still concerned with the same, not specifically the content of the themes, but the same broad themes, is because I would categorize that theme as what appealed to, what scared, what the humanity was concerned with at the time. And of course, in the 60s, when the book came out and the first film came out, something that, you know, society was greatly engrossed in discussing was class. Also, the nuclear threat, which is why so many of those early films relate to the nuclear bomb in one way or another. And I think the updated version of that reflects what humanity was so scared of at the time that they were made. That's the fun thing about sci-fi, these sorts of sci-fi films, is that all you really need to do to understand history and what people were consumed with at any given time is to look at how they write stories about the decimation of their own kind and what the decimating factor was. So in the prequels, in these more recent films, it is, as you described already, it's a kind of mad scientist film. It's the idea that some kind of scientific, technological evolution is going to bring about the end of human society. And that's just a cipher in place of the nuclear threat, global warming and nature and human relationship with nature. And I think that kind of replaces the idea of class, you know. So I think he's still concerned with the same overarching themes. It's just the content of those themes is different.
Yeah, maybe. Rise tries to pack in so much. Humans create the virus that makes apes smart.
Yeah.
And then at the back end of the film, the film says, this is also the virus that is going to wipe out humanity. And they remove, it's not a nuclear threat. They've swapped it for a virus.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because this is 2011. Maybe... Yeah, I guess it's quite back then. That would have been I can't get into what I think because we're post an actual pandemic. It's hard to go back in time mentally and really live with where society was. Do you know what I mean?
And I don't think people were concerned about pandemics, were they?
I don't think they were either. And I think it was more, it was a fancy of fiction.
It was terrorism. That's what it was. I think the West was obsessed with terrorism and guerrilla warfare and the notion of invasion. And, you know, it was only 10 years after 9/11.
Right. Like back then, storytellers are using viruses as a kind of, it's a crayon. They're 2-year-olds with a crayon smearing it. Now, anyone doing anything to do with a virus, it's going to have far more specificity to it.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like a core failing of these films, and it really comes out in the third one, is making the decision to make the virus that makes the apes smart the same virus that makes us, that kills us and or makes us thick. Because the end, come Dawn 4, the virus is mutated and robs humans of their intelligence and kills them.
Yes.
I hated that in the third film.
Well, I mean, it's a function of the original, right? Like it feels like one of those things that wasn't necessary to try to reclaim. I'd probably just let that go.
How much more amazing would it be if we lose our speech because we've been usurped by a higher power and they enslave us, and we lose speech because we get put in, because we get turned to chattel, right?
Mm.
It made me think the whole notion of film criticism is absolutely pointless, because if you don't like a film, it just means you've watched it at the wrong time.
I was going to say, just to finish a point that I was making before.
Sorry, yeah.
We were talking about the virus. I think the thing I find most fun about these post-apocalyptic films is that, whether it's Apes or another franchise, mankind just loves visualizing its own death, right? We've talked about that before. But what we haven't talked about is that it's almost always a death caused by itself. Like that's the fun thing, right? It's nuclear holocaust. It's that we create AI which wipes us out. It's that you know, we accidentally flood the earth because of global warming. It's because, however likely, we make chimps really, really smart and they take over and we all stop speaking. It's very funny to me, because I feel as though even when you look back through history, you can see often humans had, you know, some, but not a lot to do with many of the enormous near world-ending events. So asteroids, for example, we've got nothing to do with that. We have made films about how we could thwart them. So as and when we don't thwart one and it comes now, that will feel like it's our fault. The other ones, obviously, are global pandemics. And the pandemic that began in Wuhan, the pandemic that began in Wuhan, the most recent of the pandemics, there are many arguments, you know, that all the science folk, Adam, will have about the causality. And I know that the prevailing scientific wisdom and theories would suggest that we are entering an age of pandemics, and that probably humanity has done a lot to contribute to that, but not really directly, right? And also not really within our control. It's always the thing you don't see that hurts you, right? So why bother worrying about anything?
Yeah, but then, you know, storytelling, we tell stories to put ourselves in them and imagine what could be, what would be, and then, yeah, what we should do. Like they're inherently solipsistic. So of course we are going to say, let's tell the story, and that we are the cause of our own demise.
But don't you think that's a bit of a modern thing?
Or alien, like Independence
Well,
Day.
Absolutely. That's what alien. I was going to say. Like, don't you think this is a bit of a modern issue? Because didn't there used to be films where it was just that aliens showed up, or it was that the bad guys were bad, or it was that there was something potentially out of the control of the protagonists, out of control of the heroes, the humans, whatever, that happened, and then they overcame it anyway. I feel like there's a real... and maybe it's not just one generation, maybe it's like a multi-generation obsession with causing our own demise, causing our own death, us being to blame for everything. It feels very apropos of the moment.
I just think you're not wrong. I think it's a very human thing. And I think...
I love it when you tell me I'm not wrong.
You're not wrong. But like the idea, like aliens coming down... like Independence Day, it's just this black and white story. If you tell that story now, you would recalibrate it to be like, oh, actually the aliens know this, they're this really nuanced, I don't know, culturally aware species with feelings.
And it's actually
a battle of equals, and
it's because we called them bitches, that's where they came.
We need to reckon with our own privilege, and we need to have a conversation with them, and you know it would be bogged down in, because that's the current melee, not melees, the current convo is, you know what, there is no right and wrong. It basically feels like the current convo is everyone's got a story to tell, and I don't disagree with that, but that is the subtext of most modern films of this ilk. There is a lot of kids' animation is all about this. And I must have talked about this before, but it's a really good film. It's called Sea Beast on Netflix, and it's about big giant monsters in the sea. But you start with the guys trying to kill them, and the monsters are bad because the monsters come and kill humans. Guess what? It turns out the monster is man. And the monsters were just trying to... They've been wiped out to the point of extinction, and they've been demonized. That is the still... And I don't disagree with that. I don't know how many times I have to say I don't disagree with that.
That's the wet, sugary cuisine of the day.
I like... That's a really good film.
You like it?
I do. Yeah. I love watching with Rosa. It's bang on. And that's the subtext of a lot of movies, is that the monster or the baddie... The other is actually not that bad.
Or even the other.
And in fact, do you know what? That is, when you watch these apes films, I'm on the apes side. I can't wait for them to fucking... The humans in these films are the worst.
Well, guess who's the most human character?
Andy Serkis.
It's Andy Serkis. I agree. Can I say, though, there's something to be said for this film...
Rise, call it Rise, because
no, I'm not calling it. I'm talking about a different film still. I'm just saying there's something to be said for War of the Worlds. Do you remember that film, War of the Worlds? There's the remake, of course, with Tom Cruise. But think about how that film works. The story: aliens were here before; they were just kind of waiting for for us to get good and stuff, and then they come out of the ground and down from the sky. They fuck stuff up for ages. There's nothing humans can do about it. They didn't do anything to deserve it. It just happened. And then the aliens, they all caught the common cold and died, because whilst they were technologically advanced enough for interstellar travel, they didn't think about the bio environment of the locale. Do you know what I'm saying? So this, I kind of like that, though, because they show up, bad guys, nothing to do, run away, die, chaotic way, humans had nothing to do with it. Hey, what about that for a story? That's fun.
It's fun in the past that watching the Spielberg version, it's just hugely deflating. Like story, like structure-wise, story-wise, that does not connect or is a compelling ending to a movie.
No, it's not, but that's why I like it.
Anything off the trolley, dears?
You love Harry Potter.
Oh.
You must have loved Malfoy in this movie.
You mean Tom Felton?
Is that? I believe that's his name. I call him Malfoy because I know what he is.
I feel it's somehow disrespectful to call him Malfoy, even though I know he is Malfoy. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, he's not really an actor, is he? He has got no range.
Well,
and he's worse in this than he is in the Potter movies.
Well, no.
His performance in this film is the worst thing about it, I'd say. What would you say?
What would I say is the worst thing about the film?
Yeah.
Just the film, generally. I actually don't like it. I know I haven't said that, because we're not doing that much on this podcast anymore, are we? We're not really going, I liked it, I didn't like it. But actually, you know,
is,
if
I
you're
going
to come at
film.
Me with Malfoy, I'm just going to say I didn't enjoy the film. I thought it was, apart from seeing a monkey kind of go ape, you know, as it were, stand up and get on a horse, hold a spear and shout no. I enjoyed those elements of it, but the film is boring and rubbish, and Malfoy is one of the best things about it. Sorry, Tom Felton is one of the best things about it. And every time I saw him on screen, do you know what I thought? I thought, I wish I was watching fucking Harry Potter instead, because at least I'd be able to enjoy the emotional arc.
So we're going to talk about Dawn and War Of now. Rise Of came out in 2011. Dawn Of comes out in 2014. Not on the heels, but not hot on the heels.
It's not hot on the heels, but it's not cold on the heels.
It's somewhat on the heels.
It's lukewarm on the heels.
I think that's a pretty... Compared to now, mate, that's hot on the heels.
Yeah, I guess so.
You know, hey, it's not directed by Rupert Wyatt.
No.
I don't know where Wyatt's gone. This one is directed by Matthew Reeves.
Ah, yes.
Matty Reeves, mm-hmm. who obviously goes on to do The Batman. He'd directed Cloverfield. Already, the runtime jumps up from 105 mins to 130 mins.
Yeah, 25 extra mins right there.
This is the best of the set, I would say.
Dawn Of.
Huh? Dawn Of, yeah.
Dawn Of.
Here's the letterbox for Dawn Of. One last chance for peace. A group of scientists in San Francisco struggle to stay alive in the aftermath of a plague that is wiping out humanity, while Caesar, Andy Serkis, tries to maintain dominance over his community of intelligent apes. Also featuring in this flick, Jason Clarke.
Is he your main human?
He's your main human.
Yeah.
You've got Gary Oldman as your secondary human.
Oof.
Kerry Russell, who I love as an actress. She's fantastic. And Toby Kebbell, of course, is mo-capping Cobra.
Cobra.
Now, after Dawn Of, because these are a pair, these are a Matty Reeves pair. You've got War 4. War 4.
Uh-huh. War Off.
This is 2017.
Right. Lukewarm on the heels.
Jump up from 130 mins to 140 mins.
Ugh.
Oof. Magoof.
Yet more ape.
I remembered this as being the best of all three.
Right.
Boy, was I wrong.
Yeah.
There's some good stuff in it, though. Matt Reeves again, and it's, of course, it's Serkis. no one else. There are no other humans worth mentioning other than Woody Harrelson.
Sure.
And the letterbox for this is for freedom, for family, for the planet. I don't know what that means. Caesar and his apes are forced into a deadly conflict with an army of humans led by a ruthless colonel, Woody Harrelson. After the apes suffer unimaginable losses, Caesar wrestles with his darker instincts and begins his own mythic quest to avenge his kind. As the journey finally brings them face to face, Caesar and the colonel are pitted against each other in an epic battle that will determine the fate of both their species and the future of the planet. Now that's a great letterboxed summary.
Sure, sure.
What are we talking about now? Gary, let's talk Gary.
I'd love to talk Gary because...
Gary Oldman, Dornov.
Can I tell you, Gary, Gary shows in Dawn of why Gary earns the big bucks, Adam, because he's not a huge character within the film.
Tell me how many scenes Gary is in.
I mean, Gary's in maximum 4 scenes.
Tell me how many scenes it feels like he's in.
Oh, it feels like Gary is an ever-present throughout the film, but Gary is barely on screen.
Barely.
He's there for maybe 4 different scenes, and yet... he steals the fucking show with one shot. Not even the scene. One shot. The scene is that the human team up on the hill collaborating with the apes have successfully managed to get the dam back on track. So power is connected to the city. And the lights come on. The humans back in the city celebrate. Gary Oldman sits quietly in his office and charges his iPad. And the iPad turns on and he flicks onto the Photos app and he sees a picture of his children who we as an audience know have already died. And he cries and he doesn't cover his face when he cries. And it is a monument. It's a tour de force, as they say, acting performance, just in that one little moment. I believe so powerfully in his motivation in that moment. He is fucking amazing, Adam. He is amazing.
It's a pretty sturdy film. I've got issues with it, the storytelling. There's basically two key locations. There's where the apes live, and there are where the humans are holed up. And there's kind of a lot of clunky kind of back and forth.
It's one of those films where the travel between at the beginning takes a long time and then starts to happen instantly as the film moves on.
And then also just in terms of... it, like, when you travel somewhere in a movie, in a story, you want to be going forwards, right?
Sure, yeah.
And in this, it's just like, oh, we need to go... anytime you need to move the plot forward, they're kind of going sideways.
It's a to and fro.
It's a to and fro. Mate, oh, I love how you get those... get those phrases out.
It's a to and
fro. That's why I really don't like the Mad Max Fury Road, because that whole film is driving out into the desert... and then just driving back to where they came from.
Yeah, yeah.
Fundamentally, that just jars with Poster Boy.
Yeah.
I don't like it. It doesn't make any sense to me.
That's why your favourite films are Lawrence of Arabia, where they just keep going in the same direction, and Alexander the Great with Colin Farrell, where, again, they just keep going in the same direction. You like those films of best of all of the travelling films.
Exactly. I love those films. But Oldman, you see him at the start, and he's completely absent from the whole meat of the middle. And then he pops up. He's got a fantastic scene of which you just spoke. And then the next time you see him, he, apropos of nothing, goes nutso.
Sure, yeah.
At the end, yeah. And it's a completely unwarranted.
Yeah, we're gonna blow up the apes. We're gonna bring the tower down.
Yeah, and it was just like fuck. Fuck off. Aside from that, I think it's a broadly successful film.
Sure. It's the best of the three.
Jason Clarke, though, shall we talk about... at that time, he's the hero.
Yeah.
He's not Keanu. He's not Leo. He's not like a boffo boy. He's not a big star.
He's a human, you know? He's a human.
But he's a good actor, right? Mm-hmm. And I like it. When a movie like
and
this,
I like it.
I like it. When a movie of this scale, it doesn't hang its hat on a big star. It picks a Jason Clarke, it picks a Kerry Russell, and it plops them in there and it says, we don't need a Will Smith, mate. No. We don't need this.
We've got
shit.
This monkey. I mean, they've got the monkey.
Yeah, they've got the special effects, but also, I mean, they do have the story. I think the story is interesting and compelling enough, and there's some fantastic sequences in Dawn. Yeah. Come on.
Sure. Yeah, there are some good sequences. Yeah.
Matt Reeves, he's good. He needs a little bit of reining in. The Batman is far too long, but he's a great director.
Well, on Jason Clarke specifically, I would say a film, maybe I've talked about this on this podcast before, it's the film that won me back over to Keira Knightley, The Aftermath. Have I told you about this before?
You haven't, and we've never chatted about The Aftermath.
Have we not? I loved this film. I went to go and see. I really did. I went to go and see it. I remember very clearly, and this is, it's rare for me to remember viscerally my cinema visits, but I remember this because I was working in Angel Islington in my little office, just one room, and I was editing something, and I was having one of those days where I was like, fuck it, I can't carry on. It was about 3 p.m. I thought, I'll just go to the cinema, and then I'll come back and I'll finish this later. And I went to the cinema and I thought, what's on? The Aftermath. I never would have gone to see it otherwise.
Tell people what The Aftermath is, Joe.
The Aftermath is a film. It's set in Germany after the Second World War.
After the Marth?
It's after the Marth. And Keira Knightley plays the wife of a British general or colonel who's played by Jason Clarke. But they're installed in this city and they, through martial law, they just move into a large house in the area, which is owned by a local artist and his daughter.
Alexander Skarsgård. It's pure Alexander Skarsgård.
It's Alexander Skarsgård, yeah. And Keira Knightley's character is very sceptical of the Germans. And what ensues is this kind of wonderfully delicate love triangle between these three characters. It's a really terrific film. I rewatched it a couple of years ago and I thought it held up. It's very moving.
3 stars, Joe.
You gave it three stars. Well, of course you did, because you're not able to emotionally connect with a movie
You don't have to make... Listen, you don't have to make it personal.
You made it personal when you said 3 stars to me after
I
railed
on it. No, I'm not trying to slag you off. I'm just giving... Listen, you telling the audience you think it's fantastic. I'm just giving balance, mate. I'm belly balance. I think it's a good film. It's really, really watchable.
Yeah, it is.
It's decent.
Did you not find it moving?
Not hugely, no.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I think if you were predisposed to be moved by such a story and the performances, you would. It's one of those films where it's either 3 or 5 stars, right? Like there's no middle ground. You either are moved by it or you're not.
But you're giving it 5 because you were moved by it, not because it's a 5-star film.
That's exactly right. I'm giving it a 5-star in terms of the experience of watching it. Yeah,
brilliant. Yeah, like I can't argue with that. I wouldn't dream of arguing with that.
Okay, that's interesting. Maybe I'll think about phrasing things in that way more in the future.
I think it might just almost be 3.4 stars, like just sure. Under 3.5. Like I couldn't quite give it 3.5 because in my ratings, like in my Letterboxd ratings, I've got a whole ranking system, and that's why I couldn't give it 3.5.
Right?
Do you want to know what they? No, we haven't got time for it now.
How long would it take?
I mean, it's dirty.
Is it really dirty and in depth?
It's fairly in depth.
Okay.
One star.
Yeah.
Worthless, mm-hmm. Boring,
yep.
Or both.
Mm-hmm.
1.5, shoddy, laughable, but perhaps the filmmakers' hearts were in the right place. 2 stars, at least it looks like a film and might have decent bits, but fundamentally failed on its own terms.
Yeah.
2.5, entertaining in fits and starts, but lacking in story, acting, subtext, interest.
Sure.
3 stars, this is what The Aftermath gets.
Uh-huh.
Perfectly fine, decent in fact, entertaining, watchable, probably worth a watch, but not, and this is key, a rewatch.
Right, okay.
3.5, very good, impressive all round, but perhaps missing that indefinable quality to push it to a four.
Sorry, 3.5 is very good.
Good enough to rewatch too.
Wow.
Yeah. 4, superb, a must-see, rewatchable, and something to recommend. 4.5, now we're splitting hairs. An extra half point for some ineffable quality. A film that when it comes on telly, even if it's halfway through, sucks you in all over again.
Sure.
5, perfection. A must-see. Yep. Endlessly rewatchable. One for the ages, tip-top.
Sure.
Now that's my rating system.
Yeah.
And I love it.
This gives real credence and clarity to when you gave Vanilla Sky 4.5 stars.
I forgot my rating when I gave that 4.5 stars.
What's interesting about your rating system, by the way, is that...
that fucking rating.
Your rating system is basically my rating system, except everything is one star up from where you are, right? Like a very good film. Your 3.5 is my 4, right? Your 1.5 is my 2.5. I think the distances decrease as we go up the quality scale.
You are... Wait, hang on a sec. I don't understand.
The distances between what I'm saying is that if your 1.5 is your 1.5 is my 2.5, right? Read me your 1.5 again.
So I'm my 1.5. Okay, 1.5. Shoddy, laughable, but perhaps the filmmaker's hearts were in the right place.
Right, that's for me. That's a 2.5. Okay,
would you never give anything 1.5?
No, never, never in a million years. Right, would I give anything 1.5? Maybe the very odd thing. If I really hated it for some reason, but then as we move up the quality scale, the difference diminishes. So your 3.5 is my 4, as opposed to my 4.5. Do you know what I'm saying? I'm clustering all of my films up at the top end because I would never give... I don't give ratings anyway, but if I did, I wouldn't give them 2 and lower. I just wouldn't, right? 4 is very good. It's very good as 4.
Get on Letterboxd, mate. These margins make...
Letterboxd.
Watch football, you know the margins make a difference. It's all about the margins.
It's not all about the margins.
It is.
This is the thing for me, it's just about the experience.
Anyone who looks at that needs to know everything about my character. And I need to know the difference between a 3.5 and a 4.
Well, exactly. And I can't, I also can't rate things out of any less than 100. It's just not in me to do that, you know. I feel a number when I watch a film. And that is the number that the film takes. It's just the one that I feel.
You could do that in Letterboxd. You don't have to do the star rating. You can just do a heart, and then you could give your 78 or whatever out.
Well, I've got my own personal private film diary that isn't available for other people to enjoy.
Yeah, and because of that, everyone's so champing at the bit to want to see it. Ooh, what's Joe think about it? Oh, what's his number out of 100? I can't wait to find out.
I don't know. I don't rate these. Rate them in my personal diary.
He'll never share them, and I want to see them so much.
The Aftermath, Saturday, June 17th, 2023. It was within 9 months ago I rewatched this film. Very good. Great performances. Interesting post-war stuff. Keira Knightley's best. Her husband, Jason Clarke, is terrific. Plus the guy from Succession. There you go. Uh-huh. That's what I wrote. Didn't give it a rating because I don't need to give it a rating. The reason I need to write anything down is so I remember that it happened. That's it.
Yeah, that's what I do. Well, listen, we're getting bogged down. I love it, though. I love what we're chatting about. It made me think the whole notion of film criticism is absolutely pointless, because if you don't like a film, it just means you've watched it at the wrong time. Did you think you pushed back on this set as being forgots? Which did you remind me? I don't think we've got to the nub of it. Did you think none of them were, one of them was, or like you didn't want me on Rise? You said you had a particular memory of Rise, but did you not rewatch it? And was it all not a massive surprise? And I meant to rhyme that, by the way.
No, I kind of... Rise, I remembered quite a lot about, particularly the sort of the earlier scenes with James Franco. I remembered those.
Tell me what you forgot, though. Come on. Give me something. I know you forgot something.
Well, I forgot everything. I forgot that Lithgow was in it. I forgot, well, as easy enough to forget, that Frida Pinto is in the film. I completely forgot about the corporate environment. I forgot until it started happening about the big set piece scene where they go over the Golden Gate Bridge. That's quite fun.
That's a big, mate. That's a big fucking forget.
That's a big forget. I forgot they go into the forest. I forgot that there were other apes involved at the beginning. So there were things I forgot about the film.
Come on, mate. You're really underselling what you forgot there.
Yeah,
come
I
on.
Forgot. I forgot most about
Have
the film.
Have a little crumb of humble pie.
I've gobbled up my crumbs and they're stuck in the back of my throat and in my craw. No, you're right. Listen, I did forget it. And then as I went on to, and here's where I really scoffed the main meat of the pie. As I went on to watch Dawn and War, I'd forgotten them so hard that I thought I hadn't actually watched them. But I had watched them. And I thought I had a memory of thinking, well, I've seen some of those, but I never really... No, I watched them all, and they're dog shit, and I forgot them. And they are, you know, they are, I would say... It's kind of an odd thing, isn't it? Because on paper, they're fine, but they are remarkably forgettable films. I mean, really forgettable.
I was reticent to have all three because you wanted to lob in the other two. I just wanted Rise.
Uh-huh.
I think Rise is, but then people really love the latter two.
I mean, Dawn of is the best one, for sure. Of the three.
Yeah. I think it's maybe because they're so sturdy and people love Andy Serkis.
Sure.
And so, but rewatching them, I think these are pure. Forgot You Forgot.
Yeah. Big time.
Can we?
They're dead center canon, Forgot You Forgot. They are plum forgot.
I can't. This is the first time we fucking agreed about anything. I really don't know what to do now.
Well, let me add then one thing. I think one of the reasons they are Forgot You Forgot is because in the case of War of the Planet of the Apes, for example, it's just like, I don't know, like 17 different films. I feel like it's not its own film. I wondered if there was a film that had been made that hadn't inspired this film. Because at first I thought, oh, it's Schindler's List, but with apes. And then it was, oh, it's The Great Escape, but with apes. And it's one of those movies where like the ultra big baddie leader does like the religious stuff. And then with the druggy overtones, and then there's like the weird Vietnam aesthetics within there. And it's just a big hodgepodge, a big confusing pile of I don't know what, with Woody Harrelson doing something, I don't know why. There's nothing to remember.
Yeah. I don't know why I've had my memory of that being the best one, because it doesn't even have the best sequences in. The most striking visuals are in Dawn of.
Yeah.
But there is... War has an amazing opener. It's a really fantastic bit, I think, that really gets the film going. I didn't see the hodgepodge as much as you did. Like, certainly the Great Escape bit at the end.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's just too long. I don't know. I think they're fine. They're really, really fine. And if no one had seen any of them, and anyone I've spoken to hasn't seen any of them, I would recommend they watch them. Because
really?
I think they're, like, on a Sunday afternoon, like, bang them out. I think they're fine.
Wow. Well, it's interesting that you say that no one you know has seen them. Enough to recommend them, because we can play the box office game now. It feels appropriate to do so. Let's begin. I mean, what we're going to do in this section is just do the box office game for The Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and then I'll just tell you about the fare for the second two films so that we don't drag this out forever. So guessing with the first of these three films, the budget, please, for Rise of the Planet of the Apes, brackets estimated.
So the effects aren't tip-top here. It's a smaller film, but still a big film. They want to kickstart the franchise. They don't want to spend more than 100 on this. I'm going to say $90 million.
Oh, a stellar first guess from Richmond there. $93 million estimated budget. That's remarkable. Well done. Victory lap?
Yep, I'll take that.
Thank you.
He's doing it.
Okay.
I'm doing it.
Well, as you're doing it, let me ask you to start thinking about opening weekend, US and Canada. Now, let me tell you, this was a summer blockbuster, August the 7th, 2011. How much money do you think this film can make in that opening weekend?
I think it did good, man. They're making the sequel nearly 3 years later.
Yeah. How good is good, I suppose, is the question.
Well, usually in this ballpark, it's around 2025 is a solid. It feels like your jumpers are making 2025.
Yeah.
But then some films, what did we chat about
Logan.
Recently? Revenant made 40, which is different.
Yeah. Yeah.
I only just listened to that because you've only just got around to editing it.
Well, this is it. We've got, are we Jumper? Are we Revenant? Are we Logan?
We're not Logan. So we'll split the difference. Logan was 60. Let's say it made, I'm going to go high this time, $35 million.
Well, that is high, but it's nowhere near high enough, Adam.
Oh.
Because we are in Logan territory. This movie took $55 million in its opening weekend.
The top I was going to say was 40. Wow, 55.
Very impressive, huh?
This, mate, this film, rise.
How about? Well, listen, fine. People did see it, as it turns out. Now, gross worldwide. What do you think?
This made money, my friend. The expectations for this were so low. I saw it and thought, oh, do you know what? That was really entertaining. And it was, And it, even second time round, I thought it was broadly fine. I love how mad the neighbour is. You know, he's so overly insane.
He's from Stargate Atlantis, that actor. He plays a kind of like a long recurring character, one of the main cast. And he's so perfect as the annoying, nerdy little geek scientist guy that always comes up trumps and good at the end of every episode, but always starts an episode as the angry, annoyed neighbor. I love that guy.
It's insane how over the top he is. His next door neighbor is John Lithgow, who has Alzheimer's. And John Lithgow has about a forgetfulness, and he ends up, these guys have been neighbours for years.
Yeah.
John Lithgow, everyone knows he's got Alzheimer's. He gets in this man's car and he accidentally starts it. And this neighbour comes out and starts screaming.
What are you doing, old man? Get out of my car. He deserves to get attacked by an adolescent chimpanzee.
I'm going to call the police. It's like, hang on a sec. Why are you screaming at a man with Alzheimer's? And then, because the film wants you to hate him, when he gets blood coughed in his face, you're like, yeah. Brilliant.
That's
I
right.
I can't wait for you to die of the shit, of the ape virus.
Well, that was in the film. How much do you think the film grossed worldwide?
I think it made $390 million.
Again, a high guess, but not high enough, Adam. It made $480 million.
80 or 18?
80.
Oh, okay, yeah, I'm well off. I was going to say, like, oh, it sounds like I'm really close.
You're about 100 shy there, but...
Again, tops I would have said was 450, but I didn't. I didn't say it.
Listen, if we can burst through this quickly, I kind of take back what I was suggesting before. Are you up for guessing for Dawn? And then I'll just tell you about War.
I'll guess Dawn.
But you got to go quick, right? We're going to buzz through this quickly. Budget for Dawn, guess estimated. It was 93, you'll remember, for the first film.
Yeah, well, yeah.
You'll remember that.
Mate, I was going to be quick, and then you completely fucked it. 140.
Oh, close. It was 170. We're pushing up. Now, opening weekend US and Canada, and of course you'll remember that the original film took $55 million. Is this an improvement or not?
Oh, this is boffo. This is, I know it must have done, even might have been Logan. Did it? Let's say, because Logan was 60. Did it beat Logan? Okay, 80 million.
Oh, close. 73 million. Very impressive. And gross worldwide.
That is within the 10%, yeah?
That's within the 10%, yeah. Gross worldwide, I'm just going to...
Announce it, though. Announce it.
I'm just going to tell you the gross worldwide.
No, don't. I'm going to tell you the... I'm going to tell you.
You're going to tell me. Okay, tell me for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, gross worldwide.
900 million.
Mm, little overcooked there, but it was okay. 710 million, which, hey, that's a lot. It's a lot of money. It really is a lot of money. With war, we're dipping. We're dipping back down slightly. Okay.
Yeah. Slightly
smaller estimated budget anyway of 150 million. So we're down a little there.
Yeah. That's what I would have said. Yeah.
Opening weekend, yeah. US and Canada, 56 70. Million.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we've dipped a little bit back at first levels.
Dipping.
And
dipping.
Gross worldwide, 490. So we're basically, it's a replication of that first film. Overall, the thing's made, you know, $1.5 billion.
And it's been a big old break, and we're going to get Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, Kingdom for the Planet of the Apes.
Now, here was... I forgot, before we get on to all other gubbins, what I do like about this trilogy is, if you're going to make a trilogy, isn't it more fun and interesting to make one when the first film is a bit shit? Like in this case. Like everyone... It seems to be, even though Dawn and By War, it kind of tapers off. Generally, when you're going to make a sequel and a trequel, which isn't what it's called, a thirdquel, the first film is a film that everyone loves,
yeah,
and is amazing, and they're like, yes, more of this,
yeah.
Rocky,
yeah,
boom, Blade, yes, please.
Yeah. Fellowship.
Yeah. Fellowship. Nyum, nyum, nyum. What I liked Born. About this is, isn't it fun? Yeah, Born. That's the exception that proves the rule. Isn't it fun? No, in that, like, the first one's amazing, second one's amazing, yeah. Third one's amazing.
The first one's amazing, the second one's amazing, the third one's very, very, very good. That's what I would
Great,
say.
Great, okay. Yeah. Thanks for that.
No problem. It's important to have a rating system.
Billy Bourne. Isn't it fun to, let's all just decide to make trilogies where the first film is a bit shit, but it's got potential, which is what I think you have with Rise. You're like, oh, they've crammed it all in. But let's do it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fuck it. I don't know. It was in my head and it made sense. You know? First films that are shit.
Yeah, I think so. So I think what we should do, I think all studios should take this advice as well, is they should look around for films that underperform and aren't good. And then they should make more films based off of those stories. I think that would be
The problem is Rise really, really performed.
Yeah.
Really, really well.
That's true.
So they've taken, they're like, all people want the apes. Let's give them more apes.
Yeah, more apes. I want more.
Wait. Stop. Stop. Turn around. Turn around. Take a step.
Do the game, the bit of the podcast where one of us reads out a list of films to see, catch out the other one on the movies they forgot.
I'd love to do that, Adam. And I believe it's my go this week to get you.
It is your go.
Okay, so I'm going to hit you with a couple of the movies here and we're going to see if I can plumb that peach, okay?
Yeah. I've been plumbed many a time.
City of Angels.
with Nick and Meg. Cage. Nick and Meg. Well, I don't want to brag, but I've seen Wings of Desire by Wim Wenders, but I have not watched City of Angels. And also, Joe, that film is not bringing us in numbers.
I think it might do.
Absolute
no, I think
fucking
that's,
clown.
I think loads of people have seen that film.
No one has seen
very
that film.
Popular film.
Absolutely not.
Okay, fine, I accept that. What about the film Vice?
No.
Well, listen, let me tell you, Vice was a suggestion from Cass Vandalar. Lovely email.
I never finished.
You didn't finish it. You didn't finish it. Okay, no problem.
I said in spirit I would be up for it, but like I don't want to watch it.
Okay,
necessarily.
Fine. What about this one now? You ready for this one?
I'm ready.
Okay, Adventureland.
Oh, fuck.
Have I plumbed you? Have I plumbed you? This is why I was being careful about what I picked, because I don't want to.
It's not plum.
Every time it's a plum. Whenever you. There's two different plums. There's the plum, which is this one isn't one of. And then when I get you, there can also be a plum. At any time, you can have a plum.
Dark plum is first one.
Yeah.
And I guess plum is if I have genuinely forgotten.
Plum is if I just hit, if it goes right in between the eyes, which I think sounds like this one did.
Yeah, so you have to wait. Wait to say plum. Don't just go, I plumbed you.
No,
I plumbed
you. Listen, we all felt the plum. It was there. The plum was palpable. Palpa-plum.
Can you say some other ones and then come back and say that?
Yeah, okay.
Because that will be the one we do.
Hail Caesar.
No.
Okay. The Tree of Life.
I could say, the thing is, you could get me on that, though. Do you want to get me on that?
No, I don't want to fucking get you on Malick's Life. I don't want to get you on that. The Judge with Robert Downey Jr.
No,
I'm vetoing it myself.
Because I was going to let you get me on that.
No, I don't want to get.
Let me say, I'd rewatched that.
Yeah.
Recently, because I was really bored.
Okay.
But that's a perfect plum. Anytime you want to plum me on The Judge,
It's a dead straight plum. But I don't want to get you on that. The Matt Damon's The Martian, which whether you've forgotten it or not is canon forgotten fodder. I mean. It was like it's in that category of up there with the biggest movie of the year that everyone saw or not everyone saw everyone knew it existed, and no one's talked about it for 100 years.
You're right, you really are right. And the only reason I'm pausing is because it's Ridley Scott.
Yeah.
And when I very think about us doing this podcast, I think all the films I think that we're going to be doing are either directed by Ridley Scott. Or directed by Danny Boyle, or directed by Sam Mendes.
Sam Mendes.
I don't know if that's a problem, but it feels true.
It's their problem if it's a problem.
Yeah, no, okay. I have forgotten everything about The Martian. It's really, yeah, no, I agree, no one's talking about it. I mean, my nephew talks about it. He loves that film.
Really?
My 16-year-old nephew.
He loves it.
Yeah, yeah, I saw him recently. He hadn't seen Heat. So I told him, mate, get on Heat.
You told him to get out of the kitchen.
No, because he could stand it, though. We watched the first half of it, and you know, he really enjoyed it. He watched, and he finished it. He got home with his family and then finished off Heat.
Oh, yes, please.
He says he's lined up Pulp Fiction.
Would that it were. Pulp Fiction, you say?
He hasn't seen Pulp Fiction. Thing is, this is how old I am. Like, the idea that someone would say... Pulp Fiction's a film you forgot. I don't see anyone talking about Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction is a film you forgot.
It's not a film I forgot.
It's a film one forgot. Do you want to hear my pet theory about Pulp Fiction?
I mean, you're going
to
tell me.
I love it when you say yes. I love to ask you if you want to hear what I'm going to say. And then when I say that, you say, yes, I do want to hear it. And I feel more like, yeah, he really wants to hear it. So I'm going to say it more. My pet theory about Pulp Fiction is that everyone's seen it, right? And everyone accepts that it's a good film. But no one's actually watched it for 15 years. And no one can remember what happens in it, with the exception of one or two of the big scenes, like opening the suitcase with the gold, or the jokes about the burger, or, you know, the big ball in the mouth. You could get me on Pulp Fiction, because with the exception of those three scenes, I can remember basically fucking nothing about that film. And I honestly don't think I've seen it since I was 20, you know?
I would love to get you on it. I mean, I know it off by heart, but...
You can get me on it. I'll leave that one for you in your list. And it sounds like we're going to do The Martian next week. But maybe Pulp Fictions are coming.
Yeah, well, let's get old Tarantino on something. I'd love to get him.
It should be Hateful Eight. I mean, that's the forgettable Tarantino, but I also don't want to watch that again.
That's just egregiously shit. It saddens me that time has moved on so far that one of the iconic films of my upbringing is a Forgot You Forgotter.
Yeah.
Anyway, on that bleak note, you have been listening to the Movies You Forgot You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmond. And that was the Apes
set.
Prequel set. TBD. All right, say bye, Joe.
Bye, Joe.